The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me on this Juneteenth holiday. Coming up, we've got updates on two long-running stories that we've been following here on the local edition. Well, not just updates, but updates with court rulings, and not just court rulings, but rulings from the highest court in New York. The Court of Appeals has upheld Kingston's rent control and reduction initiatives. And when it comes to the battle between the State Education Department and yeshivas, New York's Court of Appeals has handed down a ruling that allows both sides to claim victory. Plus, vaccines in Ulster County, and what's up with Mountain Jam? Mountain Jam's back this year, but is it back for good? All those stories from Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, coming up in just a few minutes. But first, as I just said, it is Juneteenth, so let's start the show there with today's holiday. Sullivan County legislators marked the holiday with a ceremony honoring some notable folks. It took place at the Government Center in Monticello this morning. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was there.
The Sullivan County Legislature opened its meeting with song and celebration for this year's Juneteenth to commemorate the emancipation of slavery in the United States. Original members from the 1950s R&B and pop group The Chantels and their family members led the morning songs.
Facing the
Juneteenth is a federal holiday to mark the abolition of slavery on June 19, 1865. As part of the legislature's celebration in Monticello, they honor the Watson family, a local family who's been deeply involved in building strong relationships between the county's public safety officials and its diverse communities. The county honored Tommy Watson Sr., chief criminal investigator at the Orange County DA and longtime Sullivan County law enforcement officer, and his son, Tommy Watson Jr., corrections officer at the Sullivan County Jail. Sullivan County District 8 legislator Amanda Ward, who's also the first Black woman to serve on the county legislature, honored the family with a proclamation.
And whereas together, this father and son embody the highest ideals of public service, reflecting a deep and enduring belief in justice, compassion, and civic responsibility. And whereas the multi-generational commitment of the Watson family reflects the very spirit of Juneteenth, demonstrating progress through generations, courage in service, and the ongoing pursuit of a more just and inclusive society.
Sullivan County Sheriff Mike Schiff and Orange County District Attorney David Hoover offered memories and celebratory words for the family. After receiving the proclamation, Tommy Watson Sr. reflected on what it was like growing up in the South.
My family, my parents moved from Alabama back in the 1960s to get a better life. My sister, stand up, Linda. Went to school in the late 50s and 1960s in Alabama and had to ride in the back of the bus. That's how recent this is, all right? That's how current it is. As a young boy, I remember driving down to visit my grandparents, stopping at gas stations down on the southern border, and the distinction of the bathrooms were white only, black only, as a five-year-old kid. Fortunate that my parents moved here and that my kids never had to experience that.
Watson Sr. said it's a joy to watch his son continue the family's legacy in public safety and community building.
And now my son's following my footsteps. What a day.
Ramon Wilson, the newly appointed Human Rights Executive Director, said that honoring the Watson family on Juneteenth shows the progress Sullivan County has made in improving the lives of Black residents.
Well, it means a great deal, particularly given my position as the newly first-time full-time executive director, with me being an African-American male myself, having direct experiences as what it means to be Black in America. As far as Sullivan County is concerned, it's really good because it shows that the county is vested into bringing light to things that plague the Black community and finding ways and solutions to bring us back together and get, you know, African-American people more involved in the county.
Look at my eyes.
In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly. Now it's time for what we usually do on a Thursday, which is we check in with Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley, for all the latest local news, and we've got a lot of news to get to today. I spoke to Philip earlier this afternoon. Philip, welcome back to the Local Edition.
Always good to be with you.
Last night here on the Local Edition, I'm just reminding the listener and as well as letting you know, Philip, we talked about good cause eviction coming up the Hudson Valley, getting further upstate and being accepted, voted in unanimously by the city of Middletown. And I know that's a housing issue that you've covered a lot and covered, you know, the first cities to adopt the good cause eviction in the Hudson Valley. And whenever we talked about this, I always would have to say, okay, but what about the other, you know, housing story issues? And it just so happens that tonight now we can talk about the other side of this, which is also rent stabilization.
Right. Yeah. Those have been kind of the two prongs of sort of progressive housing reform, at least sort of tenant protections that have been playing out across the state over the last 5 or 6 years. And rent stabilization is actually sort of first. The model there was the state legislature expanded what had been a local law that applied to New York City and its immediate suburbs and made it applicable statewide with an opt-in provision for any municipality that that wanted to opt into it. Very similar to what they did with good cause eviction just last year. Now, a little bit of sort of necessary background here on the rent stabilization law. It's called the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. And the, in order for a city or a municipality to opt into it, what they have to do is demonstrate a housing emergency. And the way they do that is they survey the units that would be subject to rent stabilization. And if they, if 5% or fewer of those units are vacant, then they can declare a housing emergency. That allows them to adopt the law, form a rent guidelines board, and that rent guidelines board can set rents and make other sort of policy changes for those protected units. Kingston, after the law was expanded in 2019, was the first municipality to adopt it. And they actually sort of took two attempts at the vacancy study. The first one sort of was inconclusive. The second one, I think, was completed in 2022. And they adopted the Emergency Tenant Protection Act at that time. One of the first things that the City of Kingston's Rent Guidelines Board did was not just freeze rents in protected buildings, not just create a new portal for tenants to file complaints, but they actually issued a rent reduction in the buildings that were subject to the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. And the argument there basically was that this is for leases that were signed during a time of sort of explosive rent increases in Kingston specifically as a result of people moving upstate during the coronavirus pandemic. And there was their argument basically was that that was really not in keeping with what would be affordable for the vast majority of tenants in the city. So what happened this week was a major development in the state's highest court about those two actions in Kingston, the mechanism by which they adopted rent stabilization and that 15% rent reduction. What's happened in basically every town that's adopted rent stabilization is that they have faced a lawsuit from really just one landlord group called the Hudson Valley Property Owners Association, alleging some kind of errors or impropriety in that vacancy study, which, again, is the only way to actually declare a housing emergency. It's kind of the only door you could walk through to adopt rent stabilization. You know, it's not hard to understand the argument, really. Like, these vacancy studies are kind of complicated to conduct. For one, they only apply to the protected units, which is not every rental unit in the city. The city has to either pay people overtime or subcontract a third-party firm to conduct the study. They have to find the landlords. You know, maybe somebody was in this apartment last month, but they're not in the apartment next month. Do you mark that down as vacant or not? And so there's a lot of ways to sort of poke holes in the studies and in the methodology if, you know, you don't want rent stabilization. And the main argument that the landlords group says about this is that rent stabilization is going to sort of artificially depress development at a time when these cities need more housing built, right? So Hudson Valley Property Owners Association back in 2022 filed a lawsuit saying Kingston's vacancy study was improper. And then they filed another lawsuit after they issued the rent reduction saying that the Rent Guidelines Board does not have the authority to do this. Both of those cases have been bouncing through the courts for a few years now. And on Wednesday, the Court of Appeals, which is the state's highest court, issued a ruling siding entirely with the tenants, basically saying that the vacancy study, there were what the Court of Appeals decision says specifically is that they failed to meet their burden of establishing that the vacancy rate finding does not rest on a reasonably reliable and relevant measure of the actual vacancy rate. And accordingly, because the court found that Kingston had formed its Rent Guidelines Board properly, that its actions, including lowering rents, were valid. So this case has seen – this is a really important decision because, like I said, there's all the other cities that have adopted the Emergency Tenant Protection Act are facing lawsuits on the basis of their vacancy study. And some courts have at the local level have shut them down. Others have upheld them. So there's like, you know, a half dozen similar cases ping-ponging through the judicial system right now. Because Kingston was first, it made it to the top first. And so this is likely to be a precedent-setting decision. Less on the vacancy study rate because, you know, maybe Kingston's vacancy study didn't have errors, but maybe Newburgh's did, you know. But so less on that question and more on the fact that, like, the court found that this rent reduction is a valid measure that they can take. And certainly it raised the bar on sort of the plaintiffs proving that the vacancy study has errors, right? So this was hailed by tenants and tenant advocates across the state as a sort of precedent setting victory. These sort of joined cases were seen as a test of the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. Certainly the Hudson Valley Property Owners Association is treating it as a pretty big defeat.
Right. And I'm wondering how strong is the precedent it sets in the sense that is there any room for appeal on this? Is this really the end? Or is there a chance that the folks might appeal and seek a higher ruling?
I mean, there's this very slim chance that they try to appeal this into federal court. To be honest, it's pretty unlikely that even the Court of Appeals in New York took this up because in its ruling, all it really did is it upheld what the court right below it, one of the appellate courts ruled, and that ruling was unanimous. So if an appellate court issues a ruling, you can always appeal up to the Court of Appeals, which, again, is New York's highest court. But usually when a ruling is unanimous, Court of Appeals does not take it up because they see it as sort of an uncontroversial ruling. The fact that they took up this ruling only to reaffirm the appellate court in about as strong of a language as is possible suggests to me that they are trying to set a precedent. Mm. They know that obviously there's other challenges to other rent stabilization laws that are wending their way through the courts. And, you know, flashing way back, like, before that rent stabilization law was adopted, was spread statewide, the argument always was that, well, the state legislature needs to act to make this a state law. That was also what was said about good cause eviction. You know, listeners might remember that a number of cities in the Hudson Valley and in the Capital Region tried to pass good cause eviction over the past 4 or 5 years, and all of those were lost in court. Or struck down by courts saying that the state needed to act first. Well, the state has acted on that policy and on this one. And, you know, the court is speaking with a pretty clear voice about what that means, or what power that imbues municipalities in order to set rents.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is a local edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you for being here with me on this Juneteenth evening. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. And our next story, Philip, it's another ruling from New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals. This time they're weighing in on this conflict between the state education department and yeshivas in the state.
That's right. Yeah, another Court of Appeals ruling this week. The Court of Appeals said that the state education department does have the authority to set standards for non-public and religious schools that that say that their instruction must be comparable to public schools. Now, this has been a long-running issue, a couple of years. Kind of flows out of a big New York Times investigation from several years ago into New York City yeshivas, but you know it applies to. I think the finding certainly applies to yeshivas in the Catskills and Lower Hudson Valley as well. That found that in a lot of yeshivas in the city, students were really not being taught English or literature or basic math, and that a lot of the instruction was sort of grueling religious teachings in most often in Yiddish. And, you know, as I recall, that investigation found that a lot of young people who are graduating from yeshivas were entering a world kind of unprepared, at least by education, to work and live within it. Right. Paper wrote that generations of children have been systematically denied a basic education, trapping many of them in a cycle of joblessness and dependency. So one of the things that happened subsequent to that investigation is the state education department said that, okay, non-public schools and religious schools, their curricula and their education standards have to be roughly equivalent to public schools. And that was the question that was being challenged here by Hasidic leaders in New York City.
Wow. And so is it like a compromise ruling, just the acknowledgement that they can regulate, but they can't close down? I mean, what's the reaction from the people that even went to the courts?
Yeah, it is a compromise ruling. And both sides of it are claiming Both sides are claiming a win here.
That might mean that it's a good compromise, because when both sides walk away thinking that they won, or saying that they won anyway, that's usually a decent compromise anyway. So yeah, what are they saying?
So the group that brought the lawsuit, they're called Parents for Educational and Religious Liberty in Schools. They represent a bunch of parents who attend yeshivas in New York City. They said that they viewed this ruling as a win because the decision from the Court of Appeals actually limits what actions the enforcement actions the state education department can take with regard to those regulations. So this is kind of in response to something the education department did earlier this year, which was to close 6 yeshivas over underperformance based on those standards they set. The Court of Appeals decision, which I should note was unanimous, said that the agency does not have that power, nor can they require children to be enrolled elsewhere. To quote from the decision, it says, nothing in these provisions requires that parents unenroll their children from a non-public school deemed not to provide substantial equivalent instruction, nor do the regulations authorize school closures. So basically, you know, the group that brought the lawsuit, they said that really what this means is that parents can supplement any missing instruction through homeschooling or an after-school program. That is what we had been advocating for from the beginning. I'm not really sure where that leaves the actual children who are in the yeshivas who may not be getting the sort of robust education that, you know, taxpayer dollars are paying for. Both sides are certainly claiming pieces of this decision as a victory.
Okay, well, thanks for the update on that. Philip, we still have a couple stories to get to here, and you have an update on a vaccine clinic in Ulster County.
Yeah, this was kind of a cool story that Norma Shannon, who's a new reporter on my team, worked on earlier this week. So Ulster County held a mass vaccination clinic earlier this week out in Ellendale, giving people the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. And the background here was pretty interesting, and this is kind of why I wanted to talk about it. You know, apparently this was kind of a first, at least in our region. The clinic was open to anybody who showed up, essentially. You didn't have to have insurance. You didn't have to have legal residency status in the United States. You didn't have to be an Ulster County resident. If you were an elderly person who may have gotten the vaccine, like an earlier form of the vaccine, you could have come and gotten a booster. If you have never gotten the vaccine, you can get it there. If you've gotten it and you need a follow-up, you can get it again. And it was completely free to anybody who showed up. And the way they were able to pull this off is that a couple of months ago, the state health department took the unusual step of offering increased access to the MMR vaccine. And Ulster County's public health director she and her staff took immediate action in trying to procure as many vials as they could. Ulster County has among the lowest rates of vaccination, MMR vaccination, in the state. This was right around the time that a couple of cases of measles were reported just across the county line in Orange County. Turns out from a handful of children who picked it up while traveling abroad. But obviously there's some pockets of vaccine hesitancy in some of the more rural parts of Ulster County, and, you know, certainly some of the more rural parts of the Lower Hudson Valley as well, often on religious grounds. And so this was an effort to try to essentially vaccinate as many people as possible, sort of like, you know, the kind of old school, like, public health initiative that, to me anyway, seems like the kind of thing that we're not doing too much of in this country right now.
Did this already happen?
This happened on Tuesday. So the clinic ran for, I think, 5 hours out in Ellendale on Tuesday. And the reason they did it out in Ellendale is, you know, they were really trying to reach more rural folks who might not be able to get to Kingston, where, you know, most of the county's doctors are. It just ended on Tuesday night, so I'm not really sure how successful it was at this point. But I thought the backstory was kind of interesting. It's government sort of going above and beyond to try to help out, you know, not even just the residents, the constituents that the Ulster County government serves in this case, but really anybody who can get to Ellendale.
Right. All right. That is pretty cool. And thank you for that reporting from Ulster County. Finally, before we go tonight, you got one more story that answers a question that I know myself and a couple of my friends have been asking on and off for the last 10 or 12 years, which is, what's up with Mountain Jam? Mountain Jam, the Catskills Rock and Roll Music Festival.
Yeah, so Mountain Jam is back this weekend. the first time since 2019. But it's going to be a different version of the festival than certainly it's been in a long time. So people might remember Mountain Jam began as a one-day gathering. It was at Hunter Mountain. And I think in 2019, it moved to Bethel Woods. And by then, it had become a full weekend event. It had some pretty big headliners. The headliners in 2019 included Willie Nelson and Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead. And they were going to do it again at Bethel Woods in 2020. But of course, it got canceled by the coronavirus pandemic, as did all music performances for a short period of time. And it hasn't been back since then. So it's going to return this weekend, as I mentioned, but there have been some changes. What's happened in the intervening years is that the founder of the festival, Gary Chetkov from Radio Woodstock, he reacquired it from Live Nation. And he's kind of remounting the festival as a sort of more streamlined, independent festival. It's still going to be a multi-day festival, but there's 17 acts performing this weekend compared to 45 in 2019. And it's at a new venue, Bel Air Mountain, which has a capacity of about 5,000. That's about half the size of Hunter, and obviously quite a bit smaller than Bethel Woods. And what's more is we're not really sure if this is the beginning of a new chapter for Mountain Jam or a kind of long-delayed farewell. You know, Chekhov told John Barry, who wrote the story for us, that, you know, the music festival industry is dealing with some sort of headwinds right now. Overall revenues are up, they're higher than ever, but smaller, independent, kind of more esoteric festivals are falling by the wayside. More of them are being canceled than ever before. And it seems like that was maybe a bit of a bubble that was growing over the 2010s and then burst maybe during the coronavirus pandemic and hasn't, you know, fully recovered yet. So he says that, you know, this could be their farewell or it could be a new chapter. We'll just have to wait and see.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to find out. It's interesting he says that does mirror what we're hearing from other touring artists that aren't specifically talking about festivals, just like even single one-off gigs with one or two artists that, you know, especially since the pandemic, there's tons more money in these shows, but it's like the economy of scale. It shifted towards bigger artists and bigger venues pulling in a lot more people, and smaller venues and smaller acts have been struggling. Sounds like it's the same thing for festivals.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. That's how you get someone like Taylor Swift making $1 billion or whatever on a tour. But the top line might look good, but everybody who's not Taylor Swift is struggling a little bit.
All right. Well, Philip, thank you for bringing us the news today and bringing us some good news. We could take it, you know, slightly easy on a holiday here. So I appreciate you working on a holiday with me here.
You got it. Take care.
Remember, all those stories are up now at timesunion.com. That's timesunion.com. And big thanks, as always, to Philip Pantuso for joining us with all this news, even on a holiday today. And I'll say thanks to you for listening as well, because that's it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. Tomorrow night, Patricio Rabaya will be here with you because it's already the end of the week, if you can believe it. For now, do stay with us. We have more news coming up with The Daily, and then we get into some of our local music programs. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. Primary Election Day in New York is Tuesday, June 24th. June 23rd is the last day to apply in person for a mail-in or absentee ballot. Ballots must be postmarked by June 24th and received by the Board of Elections that same day. Early voting has already begun and ends June 22nd. Hours vary by day. Polls are open on primary election day from 6